I'm going to talk about subsidies specifically in Egypt, but I think part of that argument can be extended to other transitional countries in the region. And this is a subject that's interesting for me for two reasons. One reason is just because it seems to be of great importance for policy in countries that currently use subsidies and where subsidies pose a large fiscal cost. But it's also, to me, more importantly, a subject of academic interest, because it sort of poses an interesting puzzle that we economists and social scientists should try to address in some way. So to give you a brief introduction, and you know, many of you certainly know that subsidies to various commodities in the country, in Egypt, account for roughly one-third of public spending, more than combined spending on education and healthcare, or for 13% of Egyptian GDP, which is a very sizable amount. You can also make the case quite easily that subsidies are not a very good tool of helping poor people. They are wasteful. They benefit disproportionately wealthier parts of the population. And as a result, could be replaced by other tools of social assistance, but by doing that, you would obtain sizable welfare gains. So sort of the research question that comes to my mind is why don't we see subsidy reforms occurring either in Egypt or in other Middle Eastern countries? And that's something that sort of deserves an explanation, because to an economist, the existence and persistence of like blatantly inefficient social arrangements is puzzling. We would expect people in politics or in the marketplace to try to exploit gains from trade and move to something that's less blatantly wasteful than the status quo. Yet we don't see that in Egypt, and we don't see that in other countries. And I would like, in my 15 minutes today, talk very briefly about why that may be the case. To give you an idea of what I'm going to talk about, I'll talk very briefly about the origins and magnitude of the subsidy problem in the country. I'll talk about the various failures to reform, various attempts that have been done and then aborted. Then I'll talk quickly about what I think can account for that in a sort of most parsimonious way. We can discuss, if you want, the alternative explanations for why we don't see subsidy reforms. And then towards the end, I would like to say something about what that might mean for policy and for sort of prospective reformers in the country. As many of you know, Egypt has a long-standing history of subsidizing consumer products of various kinds. In the 1920s, the government would start importing wheat flour on a large scale, sell it in sort of government-run shops. During the Second World War, other goods would be included in the category. And then in Nasser's years, subsidies to various products, from soap to cigarettes to housing to energy, would become like the most important part of the social contract in the country, in the sense that as an Egyptian, you probably couldn't expect much from the government. You'd be hassled and you'd have, subjected to bureaucracy and taxation and so on. But the one thing that you could expect and that sort of you would reliably get would be these cheap products. These days, obviously, subsidies have gone through various sort of reforms and changes and iterations, but the two biggest remaining areas are food and energy. Just to give you an idea of the size and what that money is spent on, I don't really like pie charts very much, but that might be the best way of visualizing it. So they spent $70 billion on fuel subsidies, which is roughly $10 billion. They spent $26 billion Egyptian pounds on roughly one third of that amount on food subsidies. Largest part of the energy subsidies goes towards diesel oil, which is an input into commercial transport and into sort of industrial production. Liquefied petroleum gas, the sort of is it fuchsia or pink? Or that part of the pie. Well, that's a fuel used by households to cook and heat the their homes, and that's subsidized on an absolutely enormous scale, like the order of magnitudes by which sort of the retail price is lowered relative to the price at which the government buys it is quite stunning. And then in terms of food subsidies, which are a smaller part of the subsidy budget, the largest portion of spending goes towards subsidizing bread and bread inputs, namely wheat, flour. Okay, so why should we be bothered by this? Well, first of all, subsidies don't really help the poor that much. At least, you know, you can make the argument you could help the poor much better at much lower cost. And as a result, there are an increasing burden, fiscally speaking, both in terms of the fiscal balance of the country, but also in terms of the external situation. So much of these commodities are imported into Egypt, and as you all know, Egypt is sort of facing a fairly acute balance of payment problems with their foreign exchange reserves draining gradually. When I say that most of the subsidy spending goes towards subsidizing consumption of the rich, well, that's most visible in the case of fuels. So you have different income quintiles. Obviously, the top quintile receives the largest part of the total subsidy spending, and it's the wealthiest urban population that receives almost one third of the total budget, which is quite incredible. And you have, you know, the poorest people on the left-hand side, right-hand side, from my perspective, or the first quintile, receiving much smaller amount. In the case of food subsidies, you could make the argument that those are distributed somewhat more evenly. So there is something we could call self-targeting, in the sense that many of the goods subsidized are inferior goods, like this coarse baladi bread is not something that poor households would buy, you know, proportionally more in, as their incomes grow. But then food subsidies are much smaller part of the budget. And then even in the case of food subsidies, you get massive leakages. So that, you know, while the different estimates of that, but one sort of number that I've seen talks about 31% of sort of wheat flour being leaked on the black market. I've seen high estimates, I've seen low estimates. It's, you know, difficult to measure these things. But in any event, you know, that's part of what drives the sort of the fiscal burden of the problem. And Egypt is in a difficult fiscal place, running a sizable deficit since the Arab Spring. All the fiscal consolidation efforts of the previous era have been essentially aborted. So one, you know, wonders whether that situation would have been that difficult if it weren't for the subsidy problem. Now, the other interesting thing is that Egypt, you know, has a long-standing history of subsidies and has a long-standing history of subsidy reforms. So in 1977, President Sadat announced a sort of major set of changes to food subsidies, which led to the so-called bread riots in the country, although the reform itself I don't think particularly pertained to bread subsidies per se, but that led to an immediate sort of abortion of the plan to reform subsidies, and indeed led it to an increase in subsidy spending in consequent years. And then in the late 1980s, the situation would become unsustainable, and some changes would be adopted. So in the 1980s, you know, certain commodities were sort of excluded from sort of the set of those that were subject to subsidization. So the government would stop subsidizing meat and stop subsidizing other things. Most of that pertained to sort of food products. Also, a certain amount of rationing was introduced to the system, with different rationing cards given to different income groups. But still, there are commodities that have not been subjected to rationing, and clearly, you know, much more could be done. Then you obviously had another reform in 1991, and you had another reform in sort of late noughties. But all of them, if you look at sort of sheer size of subsidy spending, have been at some point aborted, and the country went back to sort of a sort of sustained growth in subsidy spending. And in this situation, Egypt is not unique. So other countries who have sort of seemingly done well reforming the subsidies at various points have come back towards sort of readopting a subsidy system. One such example is Jordan, where you know it looked like a textbook example of reforming subsidies, replacing it with directed assistance to sort of poor income groups after 2011. Much of that has been undone. So one wonders, as an economist, as I said before, you know, so how do we account for the existence of something that's blatantly inefficient? Why can't these governments just get rid of subsidies and replace it with something that would make more sense, like targeted transfers to poor people, or just even untargeted transfers to the population at large, but would entail smaller social losses than subsidies to specific commodities? Well, my answer to that, and that might be because of my training as a sort of public choice economist, is that the real issue here is credibility. So, you know, any effort to reform the status quo involves a contract made between the politician and the population. The politician will propose a reform, will ask for public support for it. In exchange, it will promise a specific distribution of benefits down the road. And trouble with that is that promises can be broken, both promises regarding the distribution of benefits and also promises regarding the continuation of reform in the future. Politicians can't tie the hands of the next politician who comes into the office and so on and so forth. One sort of simple-minded way of visualizing that is to just sort of think of it as a game in which politician first proposes reform and public can either support or reject it, and then in the second stage, politician can either deliver or renege on his promises. And obviously, we would like to be in a situation in which the public supports the reform and politician delivers. But because in the second stage, politician is tempted to renege and run away with the whole surplus, the equilibrium we get is that public will always reject reform. I mean, I'm not, you know, this is obviously a sort of very crude way of putting it, but many sort of, you know, interesting things in social sciences can be reduced to such crude games. That's my hunch. So the core of the problem is that the public expects the politician to renege on their promise, and you know, we know from this policy credibility literature that there are various ways of getting around this problem, and I think there are arguments to believe why those mechanisms have been underused, underdeveloped in Egypt, and we can talk about that later. But one sort of easy way around this problem is to accompany the reform with explicit gain sharing. So, you know, in the case of Egypt, you could embed in the reform an explicit transfer to the population, which would be sort of legally mandated and it would be difficult to reverse. Something along the lines of what happened in Iran after 2010. The other thing you could do is to change the structure of how the government functions that would make it costlier for the government to revert the decision in the future. So one way of doing that would be to shut down the relevant government departments that deal with subsidies. And there's parts of the Ministry of Supply, part of the Ministry of Energy that deal with this thing. There's the General Administration of Supply of Commodities. If part of the subsidy reforms would involve closing those things down, that could help. An independent regulator for energy prices would help as well. That way you would sort of increase the number of veto players who can then prevent the politician from changing his mind later on. In terms of international agreements, those usually can serve as focal points. So the biggest, the importance of the IMF talks right now, in my view, lie not so much in whether Egypt will get or will not get a loan, but whether that deal could be used as a commitment device by the Egyptian government to do reforms. And finally, you know, in sort of normal, well-functioning political systems, reputation and sort of repeated interaction with the politician serves as one way of making commitments. Trouble with Egypt is that it's a transition environment. Most of the politicians have come out of nowhere, really. I have a separate paper on that, but you know, it's a well-known fact that emerging democracies, you know, reputation and trademarks and reliable channels of communication between politicians and voters are absent. And I think that's precisely the case of Egypt. In Egypt, it's been made worse in the past by sort of Egypt being a one-party system. In a one-party system, you don't really get that many veto players. When the party or the leader changes its mind, you know, the government follows. And in 2000, you know, after 2011, you would hope that that has changed, but you need to get around the problem of transition and hope for a sort of credible generation of politicians to emerge, and that always takes time, and so they are not quite there yet. You don't have to, you know, believe this explanation for why subsidies don't get reformed. You can think of alternatives. One alternative that's cited very frequently is that there is a lack of administrative capacity in the country, and it's difficult to devise a social safety net that would work, at least in the short run. And that's a reasonable argument to make. In fact, you could argue that the origins of the subsidy system lie effectively in the inability to devise a functioning system of redistribution. But the trouble with that is that I don't see that as a binding constraint, in the sense that, you know, in Jordan they got around this problem by investing into devices that help them target transfers. They could do the same thing in Egypt. Obviously, it would take time. Even if that were not possible, you can just you know, set up a universal transfer scheme. The other two arguments, I mean, the other argument is one of vested interest. So clearly there are groups that benefit from subsidies through various ways. If you think about people who sort of run, you know, licensed bakeries that produce subsidized bread, if you think about people who trade in wheat flour, people who are involved in the supply chain of these various commodities, and you can say maybe those interest groups are blocking the reform, which is sensible, but then that doesn't really explain why you always get wide popular resistance to reform. So you don't have sneaky interest groups distorting the political process, you know, behind closed doors. You have public being unhappy with reform and going to the streets. And the final explanation I can think of is to just, you know, abandon this sort of realm of like rational economic decision making and to assume that voters are ignorant, or even worse, that are systematically wrong and underestimate potential benefits of the reform, which is, you know, something you are sort of free to do, but I don't want to go down that path for various reasons. Anyway, let's move on and talk very briefly about policy implications, and then I'll stop. One thing is that whether you like it or not, and whether you know, the Egyptians like it or not, subsidy reform needs to happen. I mean, you know, what's not sustainable can't go on forever, and they have a public finance crisis, and they have a current account crisis. Something needs to be done, and it needs to happen sooner rather than later. The alternative is to have, you know, the government sort of declared bankrupt. If you want to get around the credibility problem, well, one way of doing that as a reformer is to do the reform quickly and thoroughly and in a way that's as irreversible as possible. And that might be, you know, done even if such reform imposes larger costs in the short term than a gradual reform, because that could be part of a sort of costly signaling on the politician side that he is really serious about removing subsidies. There is some evidence from transitional countries in the 1990s in Eastern Europe where politicians who pursue the gradualist path, which, you know, could have been optimal under sort of ideal assumptions about so the information available to voters, because, you know, we know that gradual reforms impose smaller sort of dislocations in the economy. Well, those reforms were very often taken as not credible and would later be reversed. One way of getting around that is to do the reform quickly and on a large scale. Clearly, you know, you have to compensate the losers in the process, and there are many of them. In fact, That leads me to believe that you can't just rely on targeted transfers to poor people, but you just have to sort of buy off large chunk of the population. And finally, reforms are not imposed by a deus ex machina economist coming in. They result from public debates and a discussion, and in that discussion, economists can play a small role, but will not have the final say. So there needs to be a buy-in from the population. They need to understand what's happening and why it's happening, and that it will yield benefits in the future. Finally, you can think of a variety of other reforms that would complement the removal of subsidies, because these markets in wheat flour and energy are suffering from many other distortions than just subsidies themselves. So, you can think about entry barriers into various industries, the way public utilities are run, the way these different supply chains are run. And if you could simultaneously improve the way those markets work while you remove the subsidies, it's likely that you can build sort of stronger constituencies for the reform and for the post-reform status quo. So, this was my sort of quick parsimonious attempt to explain why bad policies persist and why specifically distortionary subsidies persist. I don't think I have, an easy solution that could be, that could serve as a blueprint for reform. One sort of silver lining is that there are several papers in this literature that show that the worse the situation gets in the country, the lower the costs of reform are. That obviously doesn't solve the credibility problem, doesn't say that reforms will be adopted and sustained, but the likelihood that something will be done because it will need to happen gets greater the deeper Egypt gets into fiscal and external imbalances. And on that cheerful note, I'll conclude. Thank you.